This episode of the OrthoBullets podcast will be a question session reviewing multiple choice questions related to intertrochanteric fractures and leg calvae perthes disease, which are two topics that we covered this past week on the podcast. So let's get right into it. We'll start with intertrochanteric fractures. And the first question reads, which of the following is a recognized predictor of mortality after hip fracture? And the choices are 1, the American Society of Anesthesiologists, or ASA, classification, 2, postoperative weight-bearing status, 3, fracture comminution, 4, fixation device used, and 5, type of anesthesia used. So the ASA classification is predictive of post-surgical mortality in hip fracture patients. The ASA classification was initially developed in 1963. The basic categories are as follows. 1 refers to a normal, healthy patient. 2 refers to mild systemic disease. 3 refers to severe systemic disease that is not incapacitating. 4 refers to a severe incapacitating systemic condition that is a constant threat to life. 5 is a patient that is at the point of death. And 6 refers to a brain dead patient or a patient whose organs are being donated. Richmond et al. Looked at 836 patients treated for a hip fracture and found that this injury is not associated with significant excess mortality among patients older than 85. However, in younger patients, those with ASA classifications of 3 or 4 have significant excess mortality following hip fracture that persists up to 2 years after the injury. Holt et al. Investigated the relationship between a number of patient and management variables and mortality after surgery for fracture of the hip. Data relating to 18,817 patients were obtained from the Scottish Hip Fracture Audit Database. They found that type of anesthetic did not adversely affect the 30 or 120-day mortality rate. Next question. Which of the following methods accurately describes the measurement of tip apex distance as it relates to placement of a lag screw in the femoral head? And the choices are 1, summation of the distance between the end of the screw and the apex of the femoral head on AP and lateral radiographs, 2, distance from the acetabular teardrop to the tip of the screw on an AP radiograph of the hip, 3, multiplication of the distance between the end of the screw and the apex of the femoral head on AP and lateral radiographs, 4, distance from the center of the lesser trochanter to the tip of the screw on an AP hip radiograph, and 5, summation of the distance between the tip of the greater trochanter and end of the screw on AP and lateral hip radiographs. So the tip apex distance, as it relates to a lag screw in the femoral head, is the summation of the distance between the end of the screw and the apex of the femoral head on AP and lateral radiographs, corrected for radiographic magnification of the image. So the correct answer to this question is 1. The tip apex distance is a useful intraoperative indicator of deep and central placement of the lag screw in the femoral head, regardless of whether a nail or a plate is chosen to fix a fracture. A tip apex distance of less than 25 millimeters has been shown to minimize the risk of fixation cutout in stable and unstable intertrochanteric hip fractures. Baumgartner et al. Examined factors leading to the failure of sliding hip screws in the treatment of 198 intertrochanteric fractures. They determined that the tip apex distance is a reproducible standard measurement to predict sliding hip screw failure. The average tip apex distance for successful fractures was 24 millimeters, while the average tip apex distance for failures was 38 millimeters. No screw with a tip apex distance less than 25 millimeters failed. Moving on to the next question, all of the following factors are associated with increased risk of failure when treating an intertrochanteric hip fracture with a dynamic hip screw, except, and the choices are 1, a reverse oblique fracture pattern, 2, a tip apex distance of 32 millimeters, 3, a tip apex distance of 27 millimeters, 4, use of a two-hole side plate, and 5, lateral wall comminution. So all of the factors that we just listed are associated with increased risk of failure when treating an intertrochanteric hip fracture, except for the use of a two-hole side plate, DHS, which has been shown to be an effective treatment for intertrochanteric fractures. Dynamic hip screw fixation of intertrochanteric hip fractures has been shown to produce good results when used appropriately. A common contraindication for the use of a DHS is an unstable fracture pattern such as a reverse obliquity fracture or those with associated lateral wall comminution. Tip apex distance exceeding 25 millimeters has also been shown to increase the risk of screw cutout and loss of reduction. Bolhoffner et al. Present a review of outcomes for 69 patients with intertrochanteric hip fractures treated with 135-degree two-hole plate DHS. They report low blood loss with a range of 10 to 300 cc's with an average of 77 cc's and no cases of failure of fixation due to loss of fixation of the two-hole side plate. Three failures were noted, two of those were due to screw cutout and one due to screw plate dissociation. Moving on to the next question. When treating a stable two-part intertrochanteric hip fracture with a sliding hip screw construct, what is the minimum number of screw holes that are needed in the side plate for successful fixation? And the choices are 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. So again, a two-part stable intertrochanteric hip fracture can be treated with a sliding hip screw with good biomechanical and clinical results. The article by McLaughlin et al. Is a biomechanical evaluation of two versus four-hole plates, and it was found that peak load in the failure test was not found to be statistically different between the two-hole and four-hole designs. In cyclic testing, the two-hole configuration exhibited statistically smaller fragment migration in both shear and distraction than the four-hole design. Moving on to the next question. Which of the following statements is true regarding treatment of intertrochanteric hip fractures with an intramedullary nail versus a sliding hip screw? And the choices are 1. The use of intramedullary nails has increased in the last 10 years. 2. The use of sliding hip screws has increased in the last 10 years. 3. Medicare reimbursement is more for a sliding hip screw. 4. Intramedullary nails have demonstrated superior outcomes in randomized controlled studies. And 5. Sliding hip screw is superior for treatment of reverse obliquity intertrochanteric fractures. So, the use of intramedullary or cephalomedullary devices has increased in the last 10 years despite a lack of evidence to support superiority over extramedullary implants like a sliding hip screw. So, the correct answer to this question is 1. The use of intramedullary nails has increased in the last 10 years. The optimal form of surgical stabilization for intertrochanteric hip fractures has been a topic of debate. However, several recent studies have demonstrated equivalent outcomes with long cephalomedullary nails and sliding hip screws. Anglin et al. Reviewed the database of orthopedic surgeons taking their oral board examination. The authors found that the use of intramedullary nails for intertrochanteric hip fractures dramatically increased from 3% in 1999 to 67% in 2006. The author calls attention to the fact that reimbursement was higher until 2010 for intramedullary nails despite a lack of evidence demonstrating superiority. Barton et al. Conducted a level 1 prospective randomized controlled study comparing long cephalomedullary nails with sliding hip screws in the treatment of unstable intertrochanteric fractures. The authors found no significant difference in any of the measured variables when comparing the two devices. Next question. A patient with an intertrochanteric hip fracture undergoes reduction and dynamic hip screw application. The postoperative radiographs demonstrate that the lag screw is superior in the femoral head with a tip apex distance of 40 millimeters. This patient is at increased risk of what complication? And the choices are 1. Lag screw cutout, 2. Osteonecrosis, 3. Osteoarthritis, 4. Periprosthetic fracture, and 5. Lag screw breakage. So Baumgartner et al. In their classic study in 1995 determined that the position of the lag screw in the femoral head influenced the risk of cutout of a dynamic hip screw construct in treatment of intertrochanteric fractures. They had no cutouts if the tip apex distance on the combined AP and lateral radiographs was less than 25 millimeters, as we previously discussed. Subsequent studies demonstrated a decreased cutout rate once people were aware of the tip apex distance importance. Next question. Which of the following deformities is most likely to occur with dynamic hip screw fixation of unstable, left-sided standard obliquity hip fractures? And the choices are 1. Posterior spike displacement of the proximal fragment, 2. Anterior spike displacement of the proximal fragment, 3, lateral displacement of the proximal fragment relative to the distal fragment. 4, shortening of the proximal fragment relative to the distal fragment. And 5, medial displacement of the proximal fragment in relation to the distal fragment. So left-sided, unstable intertrochanteric hip fractures are at increased risk of malreduction compared to unstable right-sided fractures fixed with dynamic hip screws. In left-sided fractures, the rotational torque imparted to the proximal head and neck fragment can cause loss of reduction, leading to potential failures of fixation. With these left-sided injuries, the rotational torque can cause an anterior spike, whereas with right-sided injuries, the rotational torque causes compression and reduction of the fracture. In addition, if a nail is used for these injuries and the proximal fracture fragment is not being held by the nail itself, this phenomenon can be seen as well. Mohan et al. Conducted a study to assess the effect of clockwise rotational torque onto the fracture configuration in unstable and stable intertrochanteric fractures fixed with a dynamic hip screw construct. They found that 11 out of the 30 unstable fractures showed an anterior spike, that is a flexion malreduction in left-sided fixations due to clockwise torque. This malreduction was not present in right-sided or stable fractures. So the correct answer to this question is 2, an anterior spike displacement of the proximal fragment is most likely to occur with dynamic hip screw fixation of unstable left-sided standard obliquity hip fractures. And the final question for this topic, anterior perforation of the distal femur from an antegrade femoral nailing has been attributed to what factor? And the choices are 1, non-anatomic reduction, 2, mismatch of the radius of curvature of implant and bone, 3, usage of too large an implant, 4, lateral patient positioning, and 5, lateral proximal starting point. So anterior perforation of the femur has been attributed to a simple mismatch in the radius of curvature of implants and the apex anterior bowed femur. The radius of curvature is generally smaller, that is between 114 to 120 centimeters, than many earlier generation femoral nails that were up to 300 centimeters, and the article by Ostrom et al. Describes a case series of 3 such patients with subtrochanteric fractures. He noted that the difference in femoral anteroposterior bow between the bone and the implant is a contributing factor to distal femoral anterior cortex penetration in intramedullary nailing of subtrochanteric fractures. So the correct answer to this question is 2, mismatch of the radius of curvature of implant and bone. Now we'll move on to the next topic of leg calve perthes disease. And the first question reads, a 4-year-old boy has an isolated painful limp for the past month. He is diagnosed with leg calve perthes disease that involves nearly all of his capital femoral epiphysis. Which of the following best describes his prognosis? And the choices are 1, a spherical painless hip at maturity, 2, an incongruous hip joint at maturity, 3, likely spontaneous hip fusion, 4, a 30% to 40% chance of a poor outcome, and 5, rapid recovery with minimal sequelae. So this young child with total head involvement of leg calve perthes disease is at some risk of a poor outcome due to the extent of his disease. More children of this age will recover well with a good outcome. He's more likely to end up with a spherical femoral head than an older child with the same extent of involvement. But the correct answer to this question is this patient has a 30 to 40% chance of a poor outcome. Moving on to the next question, the clinical factors shown to most significantly predict the long-term outcome of Perthes disease of the hip include which of the following? And the choices are 1, limb length discrepancy, range of motion of the hip, 2, age at presentation, range of motion of the hip, 3, age at presentation, limb length discrepancy, 4, range of motion, pain slash limp for more than 6 months, and 5, limb length discrepancy, pain slash limp for more than 6 months. So age at presentation and range of motion of the hip are the 2 most significant predictors of long-term outcome. So the correct answer to this question is 2. Younger patients and patients who maintain range of motion of the hip are more likely to have a good outcome. In Herring's study, children with a chronologic age of younger than 8 years or a bone age of less than 6 years had significantly more favorable outcomes compared with older children. Limited hip range of motion may be due to muscle spasm early on, or synovitis, but in late disease it may reflect incongruity of the joint. Classifications based on femoral head shape have also been correlated to prognosis. Significant shortening of the affected hip is not common, so all of the choices talking about limb length discrepancy are incorrect. And the final question for this topic, for children with leg Calvé-Perthes disease, all of the following factors are associated with femoral head incongruity and worse clinical outcomes, except, and the choices are 1, maintenance of less than 50% of lateral pillar height, 2, presentation at 5 years of age, 3, lateral subluxation of the femoral head, 4, calcification lateral to the epiphysis, and 5, presence of a radial lucency in the shape of a V in the lateral portion of the epiphysis, otherwise known as the gauge sign. So again, to quickly review, leg Calvé-Perthes disease is a disease of children in which the vascular supply to the femoral head is compromised, leading to avascular necrosis of the femoral head and can subsequently result in resorption, collapse, and repair. Children who present at an age of less than 6 years old have an improved prognosis. So the correct answer to this question is 2, presentation at 5 years is not associated with femoral head incongruity and worse clinical outcomes. Catterall described 5 at-risk signs which indicate a more severe disease course, including 1, the gauge sign, which is a radial lucency in the shape of a V in the lateral portion of the epiphysis, 2, calcification lateral to the epiphysis, 3, lateral subluxation of the femoral head, 4, a horizontal physis, and 5, metaphyseal cysts. The study by Herring et al. Is a retrospective review of his classification system. This lateral pillar classification initially included grades A, B, and C, and later added a BC border group. A Herring C hip characterized by less than 50% of the lateral pillar height being maintained is the worst prognostic category, with most children ultimately developing aspherical femoral heads. That's all for this question session about intertrochanteric fractures and leg Calvé-Perthes disease. Hope that was helpful. This is the OrthoBullets podcast, a daily audio review session by OrthoBullets, the free learning and collaboration community for orthopedic surgery education. If you're enjoying the podcast so far, please consider leaving us a 5-star review on iTunes. It will help us spread the word and increase our discoverability tremendously. Thanks so much, and we'll see you all tomorrow.